This is Liquidity Talks, a live stream and podcast series designed to share the latest trends and updates from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk. Join us as we power up the liquidity conversation.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment and part two of our Liquidity Talks, where we talk with Olaf Ransom, the banker's plumber, and our futurologist as well, about what will it take for banks to take liquidity seriously. Quite a few good points made last week, Olaf, and I think I want to dive into a little bit more detail now around the metrics and how seriously people are taking measures around liquidity health. I mean, if you take the example that one of the measures we take of our own health is blood pressure, some of the measures that are around in the industry right now are a bit like having the blood pressure from a month ago as a useful metric on your current health. So what do you think we should do about metrics and how up to date they should be?
Right. Well, good to be back this week and thanks for having me back. I think one thought about numbers is there's an old maxim about when a metric becomes a target, it ceases to be useful. And as we've riffed on a couple of times, your blood pressure 2 weeks ago doesn't prevent a heart attack today. And nowhere does that apply more, at least in financial services, than the recent demise of Credit Suisse. The numbers look great. All those nice formal things, LCR, liquidity coverage ratio, all the stuff that's supposed to be about the next 30 days, fine. Net stable funding ratio, all the stuff that's about the next 12 months, fine. The numbers were great and still they ran into problems. And we've been going back and forth on some of the comments that the Swiss National Bank president, Thomas Jordan, has made recently. One he made in the immediate aftermath of demise and said, you know, maybe we need a different structure as to how fast people can withdraw funds. The banks need to encourage customers to effectively make more term deposits would be the thing. Businesses like mine, I have money at Credit Suisse. I'm like, fine, doesn't look very good. I might be protected in a bankruptcy, but what the hell? I don't want to get stuck. I just took it out. Now, that said, you can't mandate that. You can't say only the first 100,000 or whatever. If it's a demand deposit account or a checking account or a current account, whatever you want to call it, you've got to let people have that money. But banks could find more innovative ways to keep their hands on them and to make some of those outflows a bit more predictable. I think the other part that was very true about Credit Suisse thing, and indeed of SVB, Silicon Valley Bank on the other side of the pond, was just how quickly everything happened. And, you know, this is the venture fund or the VC email distribution list where I think there's a problem. I think there's a problem. I think there's a problem. I think a whoosh off it went. I was just reading something on the train back to the Home Office today about something in the US. There were some hearings yesterday that would have the massively increase on the capital requirement for US banks. But that ends up being onerous and all of that ends up playing out on the returns, which all of us get. So we need to be a bit thoughtful about how we do this because we just want to ultimately pass all of this on to the end investors. But, and we'll come to this next, I think there is a problem about understanding this real-time liquidity management. No, I filed a report on the 15th of November for my status at the end of October. But then where it really matters is today is the 7th of December. What's going on today? Never mind the report that I compiled in November. And how do you do that? Maybe is that an area we should go into next?
Well, I think it is because certainly I've talked with you, I think, separately about the speed of sentiment and the speed of banking. And you mentioned the speed with which people can take cash out and maybe incentives to try and encourage people to leave cash in banks for longer. But unfortunately, sentiment tends to override those incentives. And if you're being paid a couple of percent extra, potentially to leave your funds in a particular bank, if you think the bank's going to fail, I don't think a couple of percent is necessarily going to keep those funds there. So if you can't necessarily incentivize people to keep their funds in the bank in this sort of world where we've got information continuously, what you could do, I guess, is measure the flows and make sure that you can react accordingly. And if we go back to that sort of blood pressure thing, maybe apply a tourniquet to the areas of the organization that's in some difficulty. But what do you measure in order to assess that?
This, I think, comes down to the difference between periodic reporting of the kind of LCRs, NSFRs, even the stuff you do on intraday liquidity, which is monthly and looking back. It becomes about your ability, or better said, your capability intraday, understanding where you are. Now, before we delve into what does that capability look like, perhaps a comment on how much do people understand. I'm known for suggesting 99.9% of the people in our industry, never mind the great unworked public, do not understand liquidity and day-to-day operations. And sometimes people don't really understand. I don't know what you're talking about. I did a test on this. One of my friends until recently looked after a region of one of the G-SIBs for short-term interest rates. So the whole day-to-day liquidity management stuff. He was around for dinner. We were joking about various stuff. And yeah, all this liquidity stuff, quite complicated, isn't it? So, hey, I think 99.9 don't get it. Only 0.1 get it. He did a little check. So he's at a G-SIB. He will take close to 100,000 employees. Yeah, there's probably about globally 30, maybe 40 of us in Stir across the globe who get this stuff. Yeah, maybe there's another 30 in treasury. Nope. Can't quite make 0.1%. So one of the challenges in this is just at the top of the organization, how much attention are we paying? You know, what's the culture?
That's a really good point. I think it's a really good point. Actually, before we dive into the more detailed metrics, maybe then let's pause and focus on not just the people that you've mentioned who do understand it in Stir and the short-term markets area, whose day-to-day job is this, but maybe at the top of the house, how many of them understand what does the metric mean? What does LCR being 160 as opposed to 110 actually mean?
So I would say at a board level, a full board level, and the group exec, whatever you want to call it in your bank, people know those metrics because they have to file the report. So in a way, the metric is, did we file the report? And it's the number. So do they understand that LCR is supposed to be 100%? Yeah, they probably do. Do they understand that if it's more than that, there's opportunities going begging because you've got too great a value of so-called HQLA, high quality liquid asset? Yeah, just about maybe. Do they understand that you're allowed to go under 100 in a controlled crash, whatever you want to call it, for a period? Almost certainly not. Are they happy if board packs say LCR number X report filing? They're done.
It almost looks, Olaf, like when you look across some of the bigger banks, there's a degree to which they're more comfortable if they're higher, which actually, as you mentioned before, leaves shareholder value on the table in these higher interest times.
Absolutely. And you've understood, because you've been trained as a board member and given the explanation of what this LCR thing, you've got to have at least 100. Well, you've got to have at least 100. I got 110. Probably the CFO office do some comparable number thing. The street's 106, we're at 109. No further questions, Your Honor, as that goes in the odd statement. So I think that's one part. But what none of those reports will do is answer the question about, can we be confident that if the wind blows, we can get through the day and do all the things that we need to do? And I think I would contrast here two stories. One story from our friends in the asset management business who had the pension fund crisis, or the gilt crisis, almost a year ago now. And one more, and an actual Planet's client got through the CS disruption in a relatively comfortable way. So the first one, with the pension funds, basically these LDIs, liability-driven investments, they have to manage in a certain way. That's the requirement. And that is likely using derivatives. Derivatives lead to margin calls. It's part parcel of the whole thing. And generally, these are all manageable. They're all known things. Somebody in operations knows he's going to get a margin call today, or she's going to get a margin call. And the margin call went 10x, 12x. If I ask you for cash, Nick, either you've got some money in your pocket and you can pay me, or one of the other many NICs that we employ, is that to give you some money and therefore you can pass it on to me. If not, you got to find some assets against which you can borrow some money to pay me. And in the very worst case, you got to sell the car to give me the money. But the problem with the last one is everybody's selling the car, so the market for cars isn't particularly good. Now, it turns out that what happened to those three, let's call them three lines of defense, to use a nice term. Obviously, if you're a pension fund, there's not money coming in every day. That's just what it is. Not the same as being a bank. Well, okay, can I finance my inventory? Turns out that on a normal day, those pension funds don't need to do that. They just do some collateral management exercises with Goldman Sachs and everybody's happy. But when they really needed to actually mobilize that inventory, where is it? What's it worth? And all the rest, they couldn't do it. So they're down to default number three, sell the car. Yeah, but everyone's selling cars. Okay, we'll take what we can get. Down goes the market, up go the marginals and people. And there's the Bank of England calling, I gather you gentlemen need some help. And there we are. So that was, as best I can tell, first brush. And one of our associates, Chris Hess, he did some work on this post that exercise with one of the funds who were actually interested in trying to understand what had gone wrong. And it was just that no way could they react and do those transactions. Yes, on paper, they had an operations department, whatever you want to call it, but it wasn't capable of getting into gear and doing all of those things. And they hadn't checked that it would actually work if push comes to shove. And that's about capabilities. That's what we call
and all that example is probably worth picking up that the majority of the regulatory controls and focus are in the buy side. It's certainly in the LDI space is around solvency, which is a much further out measure as opposed to can I pay what I need to out the door today? And suddenly finding yourself after, 12, 15 years of low interest rates and relatively benign markets in a situation that you've immediately got to find secondary and third lines, instant liquidity, it is a bit of a shock because people won't have necessarily practiced that. So there's operating model changes, there's process, there's readiness. But before that, they also need the information to show them what they've got to achieve in the first place. And I think that's their challenge.
So they've got all of those challenges. They haven't been under pressure. So you're right. One of the pressures they didn't have was low interest rates. So they haven't had to worry about these things. They haven't had disruption for so long that they can't remember what they did the last time they had one. So all of those things are true. Also on the buy side, as you said, less focus on the sell side since 2008. We've had this focus on intraday liquidity and it gets measured. Although, and here's the interesting part about this, and I don't tire of quoting this because sometimes we give regulators kind of like referees in football matches, right? And you as a Wolf supporter will know this more than many. Can we ever abuse a few referees for some of the things they do? Answer yes. But actually on the subject of intraday liquidity, the benchmark is these principles or tools for intraday liquidity management came out of the BCBS in 2013. I've been looking at them as have the team at Planix since they came out. They're actually pretty good. One side of it is report on A, B, C, and D. Terrific. Blood pressure. Stuff that happened in the past. And the other side is report on these capabilities, operational capabilities. And that's what matters. Now that applied to banks, pension funds, nobody told them they had to do anything. But the interesting part is they didn't choose to do anything either. And herein, I think, lies trap, which is financial services is somewhat obsessive about regulatory compliance. But the way we deal with regulatory compliance is the regulations get announced. First of all, we're in denial. We're like, nah, they're never going to do this at the end of 24 or the end of 25. So yeah. Can somebody go away and ask some questions? Well, they're really going to do this. And do we have to do that? So there's a denial phase. And it turns out that, yes, indeed, these regulations are going to be enforced. So we end up introducing version one of the solution to the problem, which is as stripped down as we can possibly make it to get a tick in the box. And we promise faithfully to all the operations people, everything will be improved in version two. Two is also known as the Mañana version, which for those of us familiar with a little bit of Spanish, Mañana never comes. And so it goes with this. Now, that's true on the sell side. Buy side didn't get told they had to do anything. Now, turns out, actually, there are some nuances on the buy side. Our friends at the hedge funds, they're so highly leveraged. and so active, they've gotten their own acts together. In the other parts of the industry, they haven't had to do anything. They haven't chased to do anything either. There's no choice. And when I look at all these things, and I look back to BCBS and that reporting versus capabilities divide, you can choose to obey these things. You can choose to have good practice. But if no one at the top is paying attention and asking questions, if I'm down in the engine room, no one's helping me out here. No one's saying, let's invest in the tools. So I look at this and I come up with a simple formula: choice plus culture plus capabilities at the coalface. That gets you some confidence that you can survive those disruptions and you get on top of it. And I think then you've got to look at the evolution. Now, when I first started back in this business, I was at Salons in the late 80s. They were leveraged 40 to 1. So we were pretty good at paying attention to how much money was in the bank. And I can assure you that getting close sometimes is having money in the bank. Story for another day. And all you would do at Salons is come close to the end of the day, you have a look at the bank, see how much money was in, kind of adjust a little, well, just cash. Then post 2008 and those new regulations, we got a little smarter. And that was also the beginning of Planet. So I first got to know you guys too, and other people did it themselves, was to then say, well, I expected X, what has happened? And just on the cash side, they're going, I should have made 100 payments. I've already made 87. I was expecting 126 credits. I've got 122 of them, whatever that is. And you can start to work out, you know, what possibly could be my worst situation for the rest of the day. Everyone's focused on cash as a replacement for the end of day cashware. Some did it themselves. Some bought tools like Planic. So we know that our own Capital and the team at Nomura did very well building their own tools to get started. And we know that in the UK, the regulators were at the forefront. That's good guidance. We should hold our banks feet to the fire to follow that. Not everybody has, of course. Now we can see that it's about a more complete view, that you've got to also have the security side of the house, the inventory, platform, whatever you want to call it, so that you can go, okay, fine, I am going to be short of cash. What collateral have I got? What can I do with it? Where is it? What's it worth? How can I move it? So we can see that evolution from a little bit of last hour switch between fund to plan, fund to action, to first intraday rep on the cash side, to in one place, I now need securities and cash, which I suppose runs a little counter to the way some of the banks are set up. You've got securities financing doing something over here, and sometimes stock loan is separate from securities financing. You've got some people doing some trade settlement. And then you've got some guys who are probably sort of lower on the totem pole doing the cash management as best they can, with the emphasis on as best they can. And largely those things are not terribly joined up. What we can see is,
I was going to say, I've seen an example, Olaf, where you end up with three or four silos in the organization, and each one has almost got a mini treasury in it. And then you've got the overall treasury. And when you try and get a picture, it's very difficult. Coming back to the regulatory point, I think the point you make about compliance is really interesting. And one of the challenges I've seen for the last few years is the regulators are, as you say, quite slow to move. And there's a degree to which they've got to be cautious because they almost need to make sure they proceed at the pace that everyone in the market can. Otherwise, there'll be a lack of confidence in the slower movers, which kind of is an incentive to appear to be almost a slower mover. But actually, what we've started talking about with or I've heard mention of is the value of regulatory confidence. And not just doing the minimum, which is really what the regulations are there for, but as you mentioned, dead reports that are retrospective, but actually demonstrating that you can live, breathe, react, stress, do whatever you need to with the information that you've got in good time, and use that to help control and manage the risk in your organization effectively.
Yeah, and there's a nuance to this as to what the implications are, and I think I can tell this tale. I won't name the individual, but I'll name the bank. About this time last year, give or take a month, I taught a course on intraday liquidity for one of the online course guys. And there were two ladies from Credit Suisse who attended. And I asked where they were from, and it was internal audit for the course. We'll have fun, do the thing. And little did I know that they had they were in trouble with the SEC, who said, we don't believe, they've written to the CEO of the Americas and the CEO of Credit Suisse around that time. It got published in the Swiss press. So I'm not breaking any secrets yet. They had written saying, we don't believe that you have an adequate control over intraday liquidity. So we want you to do A, B, and C and prove X, Y, and Z to us. Fine. Now, this is where the detail comes in. The consequences of all that BCBS monitoring for the strength of liquidity are that banks are required to have intraday liquidity buffers. And they are basically a subjective assessment. It's rather like, imagine we're now in December. If our insurance company for our car came around and said, well, you know, we want to see how well you've been driving your car, and they could find out details about whether we've been speeding or all of the above, or whether we crashed the car, and they set the premium for next year. It's fixed at that point. They decide that your premium is going to be X and you've got to pay it. And that's what happened with the intraday liquidity buffers. So let's just put some numbers on this. And I love big, scary numbers. My good friends at HQLAX, Guido Schremer and co, did a little bit of research on the G-SIBs, top 30 or 29, depending on how you count CS and UBS rather. The average of their liquidity buffers in total is $235 billion each, of which we know from some work from our friends at Oliver Wyman from 2018, 10 to 30% is for intraday. So that's the subjective assessment of various regulators come in and go, right, you need to have this much just for intraday. 10 to 30%. That means for the G-SIBs alone, the bill on January 1 is between 235 million and about 710, whatever, million. January 1. It's bloody expensive. So actually, if you wanted from the top down to ask some questions, you might say, well, I've heard this stuff is expensive. What have we got? What's our number? When did it last go up? What are we doing to get the number down that's in there? Because the way this works is that premium is due for January 1. It doesn't change on January the 10th. It doesn't change on February the 28th. It's not dynamic. Effectively, at the end of the year, you've got to ring up your regulator and go, please, Mr. Regulator, I've been a very good boy for the whole year and I've been very, very safe. I'd like you to reduce my buffer. You know, depending on which way the wind's blowing, that might happen. So actually, there's enormous upside in managing that number, which gets a little bit to where we were with LCR. You know, do you need to be at 112? And the answer is no, you're done. There's room to manage that and still be comfortable.
So that's really, really, really interesting, because that's one of the drivers for having the level of insight and control that we think ultimately you're probably going to need. But there's other drivers out there. And we've talked, I mentioned earlier, the sort of reverse QE that was going on, unwinding that, which sucks liquidity out of the market. And other things that suck or maybe control liquidity are when you've got corporates or you've got counterparties who are people who take your liquidity during the day and then give it you back at the end of the day, for example. And that can be quite a good cost as well, quite a big cost that you're not necessarily aware of.
Now, this gets into data, and I'm going to tell this story. I'm going to be really careful not to tell too much, because it might be obvious who I'm talking about. But there is one G-SIB who I talked to about liquidity optimization now, I'll say, the safe market 10 years ago. And we were talking about various things. And I said, hey, you know, you have to be careful with your overdraft. You don't want intraday overdrafts because they drive something else. We don't do that. We only pay when we've got money. And I know the people involved in this, and I was looking at it going, okay, so you're waiting to get the feedback. They were doing what the Planet system does by themselves. Yep. I expect X, I've got Y, this is what's going on. And they were only releasing their payments on a, you know, I've got enough money to pay for it basis. And I looked at that and I thought, crafty, maybe crafty, sly, whichever adjective for adverb it prefers. Good for you. I'm sure you got a big pat on the back, and I knew the global operations manager at said institution at the time. And I said, I'm sure that General So-and-so, as I referred to him, gave you a big pat on the back and a jolly fine bonus for that. That selfish approach only works for the first guy. It might work for the second guy, but if everybody does that, you've got a bloody Mexican standoff. which doesn't help anybody.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And ultimately you've got the challenge then, Olaf, where you end up with a proportion of the market having that level of insight and intelligence. It's the inequity about the treatment of the other participants who don't.
It all is fair in love and war, right? You know, this is all invested. So no love lost between them. But you know, if you've got the right tools, you look in that and go, crafty bastards. I can see what they're up to. So I am going to make sure that particular bank doesn't get its money until 5:02 the hour. And I can stuff them up as much as possible with money. And you would do that. And by the way, I've seen this done in Salomon days. The old joke was, you know, Citibank, the nearest 250 million can't balance their books. So stuff the money over there if you need somewhere to put it. But I've seen all of these things in spades over the career. But it's not helpful if banks do that. So we all need better data. We need to be able to look back. We need to be able to look forward and gain insights on our data. Not right now. Right now, today, Thursday, I want to settle trades and make payments. And not end up with too much cash, too little, you know, Goldilocks amount of cash from Credit Suisse in my account in New York tonight, probably, you know, $10 million up or down for the sake of it. Tomorrow, somebody might have the job just taking a look back over, for the sake of it, in November, who's always paying us late? You know, what are these patterns that are here we can see? And if you've got good data, you can turn it into information with the right tools. And that, of course, is on our to-do list and our planning to make sure that what we can do from moving from cash wrecks, intraday, adding inventory, to then looking back and forward with the data is in there to enrich the product. But yep, you need those things. If you're at the top of the organization, you should be asking these questions. Why is the LCR so big? What's NSFR? What can we do at the coalface to manage our intraday liquidity buffers? Do we know what a normal day looks like? How would we even know if we're having a bad day or an exceptional day? Once people at the top start asking questions, things will start to change because you know that folks are paying attention. And look, at the end of the day, any one of those things down at the coalface, it's a sore thumb. Just a sore thumb. You get a lot of sore thumbs, and then it's rather hard to manage today's business. And I think it's almost time to, you know, we're both music fans. And there's a great song by the Stones called The Salt of the Earth. You know, but the chorus goes, let's drink to the salt of the earth. Let's drink to the hardworking people. Yeah, sometimes we don't support those people down at the coalface. But hey, you move the meter on, if you're a G-SIB, you move the meter on those intraday liquidity costs. That's worth having. So there we have it.
It certainly is. And just one final thought from me, and then I'll ask you for some closing remarks before we close this down. Ultimately, if we've got the situation where more and more of the existing banks have the level of insight and intraday control to manage their intraday liquidity, that's going to put the squeeze on a number of the startups, the SMEs, the emerging banks. Maybe not the neobanks, because they may have the technology capabilities to keep track, but certainly the slower movers are going to be put under a great deal of pressure. And you can sort of, I can see a situation where there's more consolidation in the market, not just through failures due to lack of liquidity, like happened with SVB, where they've sort of been subsumed into HSBC in a way. But also with other failures out there over the next few years as this liquidity of a drought worsens. How do you see it, Olaf?
I think that's right, that you can see when the wind blows, you know, a lot of houses are like buildings on the Jersey Shore, you know, just made of a few planks, and they fall over at the first big wind. That you're not going to get rid of that unless you live in Switzerland, where we build a lot more solidly, I should say. For the ages. I will add, I've got a nuclear bomb shelter downstairs below my house. So I'm all right, Jack. Yeah, some of these smaller players, the next time the wind blows, they'll take a hit. Also, some of the clients will get more sophisticated and ask better questions and be more discerning. I suppose that's natural selection. That's just Darwinism, and that's going to help. And it's a free market, so people will get as developed as they want to get. In some cases, I think regulators might close people down. I think there's a bit of work out there on resilience. Yeah, thanks to do. And they're getting a lot more, I suppose the word would be prescriptive. What are you doing to prove that you can do A, B, and C if push comes to shove? And so I think it could be an event that throws people out. It could be the regulators. The effect of the regulation is that some folks leave the industry because they just can't keep up, or they up their game. And as the saying goes, all boats rise on the tide. That one could go either way, in that hopefully the standard generally increases. So if we lose a few stragglers on the way, it's kind of good for the average capabilities that those who remain, of course, there'll be a wide range between a little bit to fantastic in there. And there's some natural weeding out. And hopefully that also creates opportunities for some of the fintechs like planning. So people like, yep, we should invest in the capabilities.
Well, certainly the cadence is likely to increase. I think the speed that the regulators move and so on is going to have to increase over the next few years. And that sort of brings me neatly on to thanking you, Olaf, for your thoughts and input over the course of this and the previous session. And also I'd like to invite everybody who's on this cast to sign up for the next one, which is going to be on AI and how that can be impactful in the liquidity space. Certainly an area that the regulators will need to move pretty quickly on, given that organizations are already starting to use that technology as part of their business activities. So thank you very much for joining us, Olaf, and thank you all very much for listening.
Pleasure.
And we will speak again soon. Thank you.
All right. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Liquidity Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on the latest developments and industry opinion from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk.